29 verse 1. Okay? And the verse is that a man who needs a guidance and he's stiff-necked, meaning he is stubborn, then he will be broken suddenly and there is no cure. It means he'll be destroyed. He'll fail. This is why you're suddenly. Question is, why isn't there any cure for him? Why, when it means that he needs guidance, it means he's in trouble. He's having something problems from the physical world. Neither the problems show that he needs some type of guidance. Okay? He's running into trouble. He's having problems in the physical world. Practically. Yeah, whatever. He's having problems. Can't deal with life. He doesn't know. He keeps getting into trouble. Can't accept guidance. The first question that we have to ask is, what is guidance? What do we mean by guidance? When we think of guidance, we think in terms of, I have a problem, tell me what the answer is, tell me what the solution is, and I'll do it. You see? Right? I have to take a pill, I need this, whatever it might be, right? But most of the times, what Proverbs, when it's talking about, or King Solomon, when it's talking about guidance, it means that I have a wrong view of life. And that's why I'm in trouble, because I look at life incorrectly. But there's certain emotions that force me to operate in a certain way, to act in a certain way. And that is the problem. Therefore, I need a change in my total basic view of life, or a change in my emotions. That is what we mean by guidance. These people are stubborn, meaning they refuse to change their life around. That's the first. That's all what they're based on. What they base their life on is the very core of their existence, right? They have to investigate it. Even the investigation could sometimes, people don't want to investigate. Question of why suddenly, okay? Why he will die suddenly? I mean, why be broken suddenly? All right. Let's say, for instance, a person has cholesterol, and the doctor says he should cut down on his fat. Now, if his emotions won't allow him to do that, he doesn't see the cholesterol building up in his arteries. But all of a sudden, suddenly, one day, he gets a heart attack because he doesn't see the destruction. He sees only the destruction when he has the physical effects of the harm, you see? But however, while it's going along, the deterioration, since he cannot take guidance, because he can't change his lifestyle, so therefore he doesn't view it that way. He's looking at life that it won't happen to me. So therefore, since he looks at it that way, so therefore it will occur suddenly. Not suddenly, but to him it's suddenly, right? Is that really you could see it if you just accept your change of view of life and say, I really know that I'm really harming myself and I change my view and I change my eating habits. But however, to him, because he keeps his old philosophy, his old view of life, and that it's not going to happen to him, so to him it happens suddenly. He gets a heart attack, he can't imagine why. The question is, does it work with more abstract problems, okay? Let's say, for instance, I have a bad personality. Now, in youth, you could get away with it because you don't have to make a living, right? So you're a little obnoxious, okay? But so you'll have some friends, you won't have others. But then suddenly you have to get a job and you're obnoxious. Suddenly you find that you can't get a job, or if you get a job, you don't keep it long because you can't get along with people, or you can't get along with your boss. Or if you are a boss, you can't get along with workers. After a while, it's going to affect you. Why he can't be cured is because he can't change his view of life, the way he sees things, or he can't change his personality or certain emotions, the way he does things. So therefore, he can't be cured because of the beginning of the pasuk. What we have to ask now is, what is the subject of the pasuk, of the verse? Is that the subject is a person that can't take guidance, okay? Now, the thing is that that might be the subject of the sentence, but if I ask you what's the idea, I mean, that is what's happening, that he can't take guidance. But if I ask you what is the subject of the of this, what is the subject? Is that when a person, see, when a person has troubles in the physical world, right? Sometimes it's out of his hands. He can't help himself. But sometimes it's his fault, right? Sometimes it's because he's not relating to reality correctly. He's not looking at the world correctly, right? Now, the thing is that there are two ways of dealing with the trouble. So the subject is when a person is in trouble, when has troubles in the physical world, there are two ways of relating to it, okay? One is that I relate to it based on, not on the facts that exist, but it's based on the, as I create them, as I want to see life. Okay? In other words, I want to see life that I could eat as much as I want. So therefore, and since I look, so I'll look at life superficially, and I say, look, I'm doing everything healthy, I'm walking around, I'm doing things, I don't think anything wrong. You see, a lot of people are getting very tired of this non-fat diet, and I can't have anything fried. They're just quitting. A lot of people are, because they just can't. So they're keeping to their old philosophy of life. You see, but however, there's another way of relating to problems, and that is what is, how could I change my view of life to straighten? Is there anything I could do? And then the fact that I'm having problems, those facts dictate maybe I'm not relating to reality correctly, and therefore I have to change. So therefore the thing is that there is one subject. The subject is that there's difficulties in the physical world, and there are two ways of dealing with it. And the two ways are the two subdivisions of the subject. Put it another way. One is my philosophy of life is created by me, no matter what reality tells me. No matter what's happening in reality, even though I'm having problems, I can't make friends, so I always have excuses and blame it on the other person, you see? So I can't change myself, you see? That's, in other words, my philosophy of life and my view of life stem from within me, you see. The other way of looking at it is when I have problems, maybe I'm not relating to life correctly, and therefore I have to change the way I relate to life. Question is that that it's difficult, practically, it's a practical question. Because the only time I could cure myself, the possibility of curing myself, is after I have the problems. Is there any way of curing myself prior to the problems? The answer is yes. The thing is that when you're trained to see correctly, in other words, let's say, for instance, you have a bad personality, and so far you were able to manage in life, but you realize you're not making friends and people don't like you. You see, you could see symptoms, but because if you really see the symptom as a real symptom, you're going to have to change your whole life, so you become stiff-necked and stubborn and say, it's no big problem, I can work it out. Then, suddenly, the real catastrophe occurs. That's because you didn't stop to look prior. Or, for instance, like the illustration of cholesterol, right? I mean, the doctors, they have ways of testing. They could test it. If there's no way of knowing, then you're right. Look, we just didn't know. We were ignorant. So we suffer the consequences based on ignorance. But there's a lot of things we do know. Most of the things in our lives we do know. And we can't see the symptoms of them early enough through study and through knowledge. And therefore, you can protect yourself and start changing your way of life. But however, if you don't... If you become stiff-necked or stubborn and you don't want to change, so then you have the problem. Second verse. With the righteous as leaders, the nation is happy. And when a wicked person rules, the nation sighs. First question that they asked is that the public won't recognize that he is righteous, to really recognize what he's doing for them. To say that the public by nature are followers. In other words, you see that they, in other words, from the term happy and sigh or sad, that it's just a result. All they, in other words, they recognize either that they're happy or they recognize that they're unhappy. And so therefore they relate to that feeling, right? Is that what you want to say? Right? And so therefore the thing is that you're really right. The Pasuk is saying that the success of a nation is really dependent on its leaders, how the leaders relate to the nation. And if they do it correctly, so then they will, the people will feel success. They'll feel good. And if not, not. The opposite. Another question. When you say sad and happy, they're opposites, right? Now, opposites must be opposite in something. Now, what would you say happy and sad are opposite of? It's like hot and cold are opposites in what? In temperature. What if I said hard and soft? You would say opposites. What would be the subject of that? Would be the density. So the thing is, when you have opposites, it's opposites of something. You don't have opposites just out of the just opposites. So when we say happy and sad or happy and sighs, I mean, what is that opposite in? You know, let's try two other words, okay? Instead of happy and sad, would you say satisfied and unsatisfied? Of happy and sad, can you use the term that the nation is satisfied, therefore they're happy, or the nation is unsatisfied, therefore they're unhappy? It's measure, like hot and cold, hard and soft. They're measuring things. Now, what is satisfaction and unsatisfaction measuring? Needs. Everybody has certain needs, right? And either your needs are satisfied or your needs are not satisfied. If they're satisfied, then you are happy. If they're unsatisfied, then you are unhappy. So therefore, the Rambam is saying that the tzaddik, it doesn't matter if they know he's a tzaddik or not, or a wicked person or not, like you wanted to say at the beginning. The tzaddik knows how to satisfy the needs of the public, while the wicked do not know how to say, either they do not know, or they're only interested in their self, only interested in satisfying themselves and using the public for their own satisfaction. But the fact is that they are not satisfying the public. A little clearer, the righteous know how to satisfy and desire to satisfy the public. That's their nature, that they want to do justice. However, the wicked usually don't know how to satisfy, and they don't desire to satisfy. They only desire to satisfy their own needs. Three. If a man loves wisdom, he'll make his father happy. And a person that that is friendly with prostitutes will lose his wealth. The first question that we have is, what did the first half have to do with the second half? It's very far. I mean, it should say something. I mean, from a love of learning, the person that visits prostitutes, I mean, that's a big jump. So the question is, what is he talking about? The second question is, how is visiting prostitutes, how would it make you lose all your wealth? How does that make you lose your wealth? Why can't you have both? The question is, why doesn't it say, why does it say in one half you'll make your father happy, and in the other half it says you'll lose wealth? I mean, it doesn't fit. It should say,
on the first half, you will be wealthy, and the second half, you'll lose your wealth. Well, in the first half, it say you make your father happy, and the second half, it say makes your father not happy. But it seems to be talking about two different things. This is, what should we do? What's the approach that we should take to answer the questions? Where should we go? How should we deal with it? Okay, so we have to really find out what the subject is so that we can know what we're talking about. What's the subject of the pasuk? Avram says that the subject is love. Okay? What is love? Love is something that you are drawn to. Okay? Okay, so the we're talking about that which you are drawn to. You could be drawn to either learning, or you could be drawn to prostitutes. But the pasuk is saying, be a big jump. That seems to be a big jump. Now you must ask, is what about people that are drawn to money? They're drawn to money. They're not wise, but they'll definitely won't lose their wealth. They're drawn to money, they train how to make money, and they make money. There are a lot of people that make money. And they're drawn to money, they have a love of money. Isn't that mentioned in the pasuk? Is that some of the Mefarshim, Rashi quotes a Chazal, and the Meiri speaks about it, and the Malbim speaks about it, as that the pasuk is talking about the method of thinking, and both sides is talking about thinking. Then you're going to have to say that the second half is a metaphor, okay? And it's okay to go with the metaphor, but if at all possible, I always like to define the pasuk, even though it might seem, unless you have no way out, then you have to have to define the pasuk as a metaphor, but I'd rather, if at all possible, try and stick to the plain shot first, at least, anyway. In other words, like, I understand that if a person visits prostitutes, he's involved in the total involvement in the physical pleasures, the odds are he's not going to be involved in making money, which you have to be involved in. And therefore, he's not going to take care of business, and he's going to lose on the, he'll be involved in the physical, and he'll lose the money. That I understand. I understand that side in and of itself, that side. Where I'm lost is that there's so many other things. I mean, that a person could be drawn to money, a person is drawn to sports, a person is drawn to a lot of different things. It's not either learning or prostitutes. It's very far apart, those two. It's very far apart. It's like a big jump. In other words, you must find something about the relationship between learning, being a love of learning and a love of prostitutes that will exclude any other love. It has to be that way. Because if it wasn't that way, then the question is, why do they make such a big jump? It should just be where you're drawn to anything. But when it says prostitutes, that's a big jump from learning. I mean, let's say a businessman. I mean, he's involved in... would say a love of money in comparison to a love of prostitutes. So you would say a love of money, it is a possibility you're going to make it. But a love of prostitutes, you'll never make it. I mean, that I could understand, then there's some connection there. But however, to jump from chachma to prostitution, that's too big of a jump. It just doesn't make sense. The thing is that there are two types of pleasures. There is a physical pleasure and a pleasure based on a fantasy, or it's the pleasure is based on an idea. Okay? Like, for instance, money. There is no, I can't hug money, I can't, you know what I mean? There's no physical pleasure in money. It represents an idea that I have money, and therefore, I have something special. So it's the idea that gives me the pleasure. So I'm drawn really to an idea. Competition, I'm drawn to an idea. I mean, I'm running. And then I beat the other person in running, right? Now the thing is so what? Let's say I ran without anybody. Physically, I'm doing the same act. But what I enjoy is the idea. If I enjoy running, so then I enjoy running. That's a physical pleasure. But if I enjoy winning, so then I'm enjoying an idea that somehow I enjoy this idea that I beat the person. Like there's certain people that if they stay on a telephone pole longer than anybody else, so then they say they're great, right? It's all an idea. Sitting on a telephone pole is no pleasure. It's not a physical pleasure, you see? Now, learning also is a pleasure. It's a pleasure that you experience. It's not based on an idea. When you see the ideas, you see, so that when you see the ideas, that in itself is an enjoyment. But it's not the pleasure of that I'm creating some idea that I'm creating that I am enjoying this. That's a different type of fantasy. You see? So when they say love of an object, they're talking about that you experience a certain enjoyment of the object. And therefore, there are two types. There is that there is the enjoyment of the idea. So that's an idea that I really experience. And then there's the enjoyment, the physical enjoyment of prostitutes. You see? So then when I have the physical enjoyment of prostitutes, so that's an object of pleasure. It's a physical pleasure. You see? So I'm drawn to that physical pleasure. But by money and by other things, it's not a real... It's a pleasure that's totally built up in your mind. We're comparing experiencing pleasures. The subject really is experiencing pleasures. It's not a pleasure that I enjoy a certain idea, right? Like, let's say, for instance, you're an actor, right? And people clap. Now, you enjoy the idea that you don't experience what they got out of the play, and you don't experience their clapping. But it's the idea when they do that physical thing, so you interpret it somehow, that's a pleasure to me. You see? So the whole thing is based on an interpretation. But here there's a real physical pleasure. The pleasure itself is physical. Buying it now, then competition and love of money doesn't fit into this pasuk at all. Because the thing is, there's no physical enjoyment there at all. In learning, there's an experience. It's true, it's not physical. But the thing is, there's an experience that you experience when you see the idea. But in money, I don't experience anything. I only interpret. It's totally based on an interpretation that I get an enjoyment. These pleasures of the pasuk is an experience that you experience. However, love of money, you don't experience anything. But you interpret that money is the greatest thing in the world. It's your interpretation that makes it great. But however, it's not anything you experience. So therefore, they're only dealing with pleasures that you actually experience. I could start analyzing to go further in the analysis. The first thing that we have to do is understand the pasuk to make sense out of the pasuk. And the only way this verse can make any type of sense is as if you're talking about pleasures that you experience. Now you might ask a question, why does it deal with that? And what is the differences? And another question is there are physical experiences that aren't good? Let's say you go jogging. You can't say jogging is an evil. You can't say you're going to lose your wealth. You enjoy jogging, and that's a physical experience. There's eating. We make blessings over eating, right? So the thing is that these are physical experiences. That doesn't mean that all physical experiences. So we have to further investigate the pasuk. All we established at this point is to understand the pasuk is only dealing with those pleasures that you experience. And now we need an analysis of those type of pleasures. What's the difference between learning and sex, and what is the and prostitutes, and what is the difference between prostitution and, let's say, enjoying jogging? Well, let's say sex itself. Sex itself is nothing wrong. We have laws of getting married. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not going to make you lose your wealth. It's prostitution. So we have to understand that. But I'm just trying to set up what I did until now is to set up the pasuk that it should make sense. Before this, the pasuk simply didn't make sense. What they're dealing with, what is the subject here? The subject is where I'm drawn to a pleasure that I experience. That's what we're comparing. Okay? That's what we did till now. The thing is that dealing with the pasuk is saying that there is a certain pleasure in sex. Okay? It's a physical pleasure. Okay? But the only thing is, that the question is, when a person goes to a prostitute, it means that he goes to many. In fact, the pasuk uses the plural. A person that goes to a prostitute doesn't just go to one prostitute. Usually he goes to many different prostitutes. Now, when you go to many different, why do you need many? There's only one enjoyment. Whatever the enjoyment is, it's one enjoyment. What is the difference if you go to many different? When you go to many different prostitutes, that represents a fantasy. It's not a real physical pleasure, you see? And what the pasuk is trying to say, that the person has to be very careful about physical pleasures to know exactly how much is a reality, a real pleasure, and when the physical pleasure is going too much. Like, for instance, by food. What is the pleasure? I'm hungry. I remove hunger, so therefore I'm satisfied. But let's say a person has to constantly eat, you see, and he runs off to all different types of things that are not good for him. Then food represents a fantasy. So what the pasuk is saying is that there is a, is that in the physical fantasy, see, in all the other, like money, that by definition is a fantasy because there's no experience. But even in the physical pleasures where there are experiences, the person has to be very careful to define clearly what is the pleasure, what is the physical pleasure, and what is the fantasy. So why does it say in the first half of the pasuk Yisamach Aviv, and the second that he will make his father happy, and the second half he'll lose his money, his wealth? What we want to say is that he'll make his father happy. It means because overall the wise child will be successful all around. He'll be successful in his pleasures because he'll know exactly how far to go. And because he is wise and he's very careful about the physical pleasures, he'll also know how to take care of his money and all his other basic needs and all his practical needs. So therefore, when he takes care of it correctly, he will be successful. That's what a parent wants, to see his child successful. But the one that runs after the physical pleasures in a fantasy way, that person will fail. He'll lose his money. His father will be unhappy. So he will be a failure. And that's what it means his father is happy. His father is happy means that he's successful. The other half will lose even any money that he did have. He'll lose, which of course will make his father unhappy. Up to Pasuk Dalet, and Pasuk Dalet says, a king with justice will establish or make firm the country, and a man of taxes will destroy it. This is that every land must have taxes, so why is taxes so bad? Taxes destroy it. Therefore, the Pasuk is talking about justice. The second half of the pasuk is talking about taxes. So the question is, what is the subject? First half, does it use the term melech, and the second half, it uses the term ish? That the subject of the first half is justice, and the subject of the second half is taxes. So the truth is, you have two possible subjects. Either the subject is justice, or the subject is taxes.
And you will see that the different commentaries have both as a subject.
Or the other.
For if you say that the subject is justice, then a man of taxes means that he's involved totally with taxes, with evil, just for himself, for his own gain. In other words, he is unjust. And that, and taxes only represents a type of injustice. But we're talking about justice and injustice. If we're talking about the subject of taxes, that there are two types of taxes. There's a taxes that's the exact amount which is necessary to run a government. And then there's taxes which you take beyond for your own personal needs. You see? Take the exact amount. By mishpat, it means that you take, when you talk about a king of justice, so then you're talking about a king that when he makes taxes, he gives the precise amount which is necessary for the government. But however, when you're talking about a man of taxes, it means that he's involved, which is collecting taxes, which means that he wants to take money for himself. So there's two ways of analyzing this verse. The method that we should bring out from here is that whenever you have the question, or most of the times, when you have the question, what does one part have to do with the other, then each one has a different subject, which makes it possible to have either subject, and usually you'll see commentaries that have two different subjects, it's just they took which one side to be the subject, and then they fit in the other side. So we're going to go with that the subject is taxes, which is the commentary of the Ibn Ezra. That's how the Ibn Ezra approaches it. So we're going to approach this that if you take exact taxes, then you will be successful. If you don't, if you take more than what is necessary, then you will destroy the government. Now the question is why? Why does that destroy the government? We understand that people are going to rebel, but we have to see precisely that it is part of the laws of nature. You have to see clearly that there's no doubt. The thing is that we want to say that if, after a while, because since you take more, so there's nothing to stop you from taking, since it's not rational, it's only an emotion, so the emotion doesn't know an end until you destroy the government, okay? Until you take too much and you just destroy the government. That is true. But I think also it destroys, when you take more, there is a anger from the people towards... Let's put the question differently. Why is it that when a king takes taxes, that he's, when it's just, that the people wouldn't be upset? But if a person takes more taxes, then the people will be upset. What caused them to be upset? You're going to say justice, I mean, the public is not really just, you know what I mean? In other words, somehow, emotionally, it's not that they're against taxes. They're able to accept that you take taxes. And it's not because they went through all the theories and understanding of government, but somehow that doesn't affect their emotions, like when you take too much. Saying that you're going to destroy the economy if you take too much taxes. I mean, because you're not going to have for the government, and you're going to start taking away from the government, and the people won't have, they'll have less to spend, and after a while you're going to destroy the economy. That's definitely a way that you'll destroy it. There's no question about it. But I think there is something within the nature of the human. I'm trying to explain it that if the people, if it's a just king, so they see that the taxes is really for the government, meaning for themselves. Yeah, I mean, then he's thought it out already. We're talking about the public. They look at things more superficially, and I don't believe it's that thought out. The question is, why aren't they upset at taxes, period? They should be upset at taxes. That's what we have to explain. Okay, I'll give you an illustration. Many years ago, when I first came to Seattle, So everybody that I saw when they drove, they always kept the law. They stopped at every single point. Now when I'm on the highway, I see there's a tremendous amount of competition and people cutting off. And what happened all of a sudden, you know what I mean? That all of a sudden, I mean, it wasn't all of a sudden, it's over many years, but what happened? The answer is that a person is willing to be nice.
as long as everybody else is nice. You see? As long as they don't see anybody taking advantage of them. In other words, it's not that people are just, but most people would work with others. But if they sense that somebody's taken an advantage, then suddenly they can't do it anymore. See, in other words, a man, a real person of justice, even if the whole Klal Yisrael was against Moshe and screamed at Moshe, but he was a man of justice and therefore he had to continue. That's it. Whatever happened, it had nothing to do with them, whether they were nice to him or not. He had to do that which is just. But most people do not do. Most people, when they keep a certain amount of justice, is because they don't feel that anybody's taken advantage of them. But as soon as they sense that people are taking advantage of them, then they can't tolerate it. You see? So therefore, if they see that everybody's giving taxes, and the king is also involved with doing the right thing, where he doesn't see where he has any special advantage. He understands that the king has a palace, or things like that, that he has more. But he doesn't sense, and he doesn't pick up any unfair advantage, then he's willing to be a life of justice. Not because he's a just person, but as soon as the person senses that somebody's taken advantage of him, then the anger builds up, you see? And once or twice maybe you could take it, but after a while he's just going to start doing the same thing that the other people are doing, and slowly but surely the whole place is going to break down. Saying is that people are fair as long as they don't feel that anybody's taken advantage. But once we take Pusakei, the Ibn Ezra says that Pusakei and Pusak Vav are one subject, so we'll take them both together. Okay? It says a man that makes smooth on his friend. What he means is he shows that it's very smooth, but really he's going to fail, like a trap. Like the way the Malbim says, it's like a trap that you're setting for an animal, so you make it very smooth, so he should notice it and he falls in. So the same thing when you speak smoothly, you know, you tell him how great the thing is, and to trap him, then the consequences is that a trap will be spread on his feet. His feet meaning the feet of the person that set the trap. Okay? Plus, and the verse 6 says that the evil of the crime of an evil man is his trap, and the righteous will sing and be happy. He interprets that the trap will spread out for his feet, goes back to the person that set the trap. And there's, of course, a lot of people that set a trap, they don't fall into their own trap. How is it that they, where do you see that they have to fall into their own trap? Yeah, happiness, the singing and happiness of the righteous. What does that have to do with anything? Crime of a wicked man is a trap. What does that mean? How does that work? Set up the pasuk like the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says like this. A person that makes a trap, a hidden trap for his friend, then that trap will spread over his own feet. Okay? He'll be caught in his own trap. What's the proof of that? Because of the next verse. Because the next verse makes a general principle in general. That the crime of the evil man is his very trap. Okay? So therefore we don't have to explain the first pasuk in particular. But what we have to do is explain how a crime is the very destruction of the person that does it. That is the worst consequence to the person. Most of Mishlei deals with consequences that you do, let's say you'll go out into the sun and you'll get a sunburn, so that's your consequence for not taking watching, okay? But here we're saying that the act itself is a consequence. That's what we have to explain. Because we have to see, the first thing that we have to see is how a crime, the act itself, is the very consequence already for the evil person.
It's
the very trap. We know that, let's say for instance, a person, most people don't start off by being murderers. What they start off is by, they start stealing, and they get a little bigger, and then they're afraid to get caught, so they start carrying a gun only to frighten the other person. And then all of a sudden they start killing. Okay? There's certain people that way. Not everybody. I'm not giving universal that all people go live that way. But I'm saying there are people that are that way. And there seems to be some progression. Okay? What I would like to know is, how does the progression work? Why is there such a progression? How does the progression work within the human? Okay? Right. So I say that the progression works, you see, the thing is that when you start out, so usually you have a certain identification with other people. Now, when you harm a person, that means with that person you don't have identification. You can't harm a person that you identify with. At least at that moment you don't identify with him. That's the only way you could hurt him, right? Okay. Now, as you start stealing and harming the person, so you're breaking identification with the other person. Okay? As you break your identification with the other person, then you have less regard for the other person. So first you have less regard for his monetary things or for small things. You know, you steal small things. Then after a while you could take away bigger things. Then you could take away his whole livelihood, take away all his money. And then it's a matter of the next thing, you have no regard. You could take his life. Okay? What people do not notice, that every time you do an act, it affects your whole personality, it affects your whole soul, your whole being. So therefore, when you do an evil act, the thing is that is affecting who you are. When you do an irrational act, and you go according to your emotions, then it affects who you are. People only look at evil only on the action. And it is true, I mean, you're hurting other people, that's an evil act. But you don't realize that every act that you do rationally affects your soul one way, and every act that you do irrationally then affects your soul another way. And every time you do an act irrationally, so then it affects your soul, it's a progression that slowly it gets starts getting worse. Starts spreading out. In other words, like, where I have no regard for another person, it starts first, I don't have regard, I'll steal a pen. But then later, after a while, I have less regard for a person, I could steal more, until I could take away a lot of things, until I could actually take away his life. You see? So therefore, in any area of evil, there is always a progression. There's only one type of progression. I'm saying there are many, many different types of progression. And the act affects your total being. That's why he says the act of the evil man is the trap. Because people look at an act as a separate entity. That it's just an act, it's a bad act. It's not so, but every act that you do affects your very soul. The question is that the person doesn't realize, the wicked person doesn't realize this, so he just doesn't realize this. So the answer is that you're right. He doesn't realize this. That's why he's able to do it. But if you realize that every time you did an act, like let's say by the picture of Dorian Gray, right? Where every time he did an evil act, it changed the picture. And you were able to see every time you did an evil act, you were able to see how it affects your soul exactly. It'd be impossible for you to do evil. But it's only because you're ignorant of this idea that you're able to do evil because you don't see how it's affecting your soul. The question is, why is the tzaddik happy? Okay. The tzaddik is happy, according to the Ibn Ezra and according to a few other mefarshim, is because when he sees the destruction of the wicked, he's happy because he sees God's system is working. if he is happy because he sees the destruction of the wicked, that is not right. I mean, he's like, it's a vengeance type thing. But what the tzaddik is happy about is that he sees God's system is, God created even the laws of nature, that when you do evil, you must be affected by evil. And slowly but surely, that very evil will destroy you. You see? Now, when the tzaddik sees the progression, and therefore the destruction of the Russia, he is happy because he sees that God's system, he's seeing God's system. Just like, for instance, if you see some idea in the system of how things work, and you see and you really recognize and you relate it back to God, you're happy about God's system, you could be just as happy when you see that when a person doesn't live according to the ideas of Torah, and he gets the consequences of that, you're not happy that he's getting the consequence. But what you're happy about is that the system really works, that you really see the system. And once you see the system, the two things happen. One is that it's a closer relationship to God because you see God's system is really works. And two, it affects you more insofar as you're doing it. That's like really seeing the act really destroys you. So therefore, he really sees that you... Just because he didn't do it doesn't mean that it's not wrong. And he's making a trap himself. Then the next verse says, it continues, it's continuing, and it says, a evil man. You see, usually it says a wicked man. The evil man means, with the sin of the evil man, means that he talks somebody into it. Even though he didn't do it, he's trapping himself. Now the righteous is happy with the system working. Okay. Now what does these two things have to do together? What is the subject of the whole verse? They have to understand that we relate to God through His systems. So when we see His systems working, we could look at the stars and see the physics, and we could see. The ecological system, any system, that's the way we relate to God via His systems. Now, part of His system is that the evil man must fail. He must fail at some point. So the thing is that when the righteous man sees that this type of person actually fails, and he's affected by his own trap that he's trying to trap others, and he's affected by it, and he's really hurt. So he sees God's system working, you see. So therefore, the subject of the verse is systems, is God's systems. But there's two things: there's God's systems operating, and the human being seeing God's system. In this verse, the system working is he's watching the evil man, just like he would watch at the animals and see the wisdom of the animals. The Ibn Ezra says that when you see how the animals operate and all the wise things that they do, so you see God's wisdom. Now the same thing here: when you see the system is the evil man is doing wrong. And then he is harmed. That is the system operating. Then the other part is the righteous watching the system operate. You see? So the verse is talking about God's systems, and then there are two parts. There's the system. One part is talking about what happened in the system, and then the result of the righteous seeing the system, so he is excited about seeing God's system work, just like he would be excited
where he would see the stars work according to a system, and he's excited about seeing the all the animals, the wisdom of the animals, because then again he is seeing God and he's relating to God that way, so therefore he is excited. That's what the verse is talking about. In other words, when you study Mishlei, Proverbs, you see that by definition, the way the wicked people operate, that they must fail. So therefore, when you see that they actually fail, so then you see the system working. Like, let's say, for instance, you predict a certain star should be in a certain place, so you're happy because you see that, that your understanding of the system is so well that you can predict. Now, when you understand the system of Mishlei, of Proverbs, so you recognize that the wicked should fail. So therefore, when you understand the system that way, and you see the wicked actually fail, so then you see the system actually working. That is how you relate to God, when you see God's system, and so work. Okay, we're doing verse 7, and it says, the proverb says that the righteous know the law of the poor, but the wicked do not understand knowledge. Law could be mean one of two things. The word law could mean like a system of justice, or it could mean like a law of nature, like the nature of the poor. It could be either one, and we could analyze both. Or we could analyze one of the two, whichever one you want to. Analyze it as that law over here means a court of law. First question that's asked is that it says the righteous know the law of the poor, and the wicked don't understand knowledge. Like, what does one half have to do with the other? What does it have to do with knowledge? It's two different things. Which should say they don't understand justice. They don't understand something like that, but not that they don't understand knowledge. The question is the subject law or is the subject knowledge? What is the law of a poor person different than anybody else? It should say that he knows law, and the wicked don't understand knowledge. But why does it say the law of a poor person? Why does it say you understand knowledge? Either you have knowledge or you don't have knowledge. What does it mean he doesn't understand knowledge? It's a good question. Intuitively, which question should we deal with first? It's hard to deal with all these questions, but you have to use one of them to start thinking, to guide, to go, right? Which one would you say we should start with? The question is that we shouldn't take up the subject, what the subject is, because you have to understand each side first, so you have to take the problems with what is the... why does it say the law of the poor? It just says just to say law, and we should also take up what does it mean he doesn't understand knowledge. We have you want to say that we should take the subject first, okay? Now the problem is we have two pieces of information that make up the subject, and these two pieces of information are saying that there's a different subject. The first half of the proverb is saying that. That law is the subject, and the second half of the verse is saying that knowledge is the subject. So I can't decide on that till I understand, clarify both each side separately, and then maybe see how it works. As somebody saying is maybe we should analyze the two possible subjects and see what they have in common. Okay, in other words, we have a subject of justice. We have a subject of knowledge, see what they have in common. Okay, maybe we should start that way. I think the only thing that you could say about them is knowledge seems to be a very general subject, and justice is a particular type of science. Okay, that's fine, but how are you going to decide what's the subject of the verse? You still can't decide which is the subject of the verse when you compare them. The only thing is, I know knowledge is a universal. It includes all different types of knowledge. It's a general statement. And the other one is a particular type of subject, justice, particular study. So fine, but now which one is the subject, the particular or the universal? to go the first approach, namely to get each side very clear, so and then somehow, slowly but surely, maybe we'll be able to see what the subject is. I have to say, to make any sort of comparison here, that the wicked person has a knowledge of law. Let's say a lawyer, okay, a wicked lawyer. Then I could understand, at least then there is some comparison to start with. So then he does have knowledge. So the question for you would ask, so he does have knowledge, so why does it say he doesn't understand law? He doesn't understand knowledge. He does understand because he's a lawyer. Does he know what to do with the knowledge? He knows what to do with the knowledge. He knows how to win a case. You know justice, then what does he know? Say that the wicked person knows the law enough to maneuver the system for his own benefit. Talking about a lawyer that knows law, he's a good lawyer. But the only thing is he uses the law for his own benefit. We didn't answer the question, what does it mean he doesn't understand knowledge? So according to this, he does have knowledge. If he could use the law to manipulate, so he does have knowledge of the law. We didn't answer any of the questions. We're just setting up the facts at this point. In other words, to make some comparison, we have the righteous and the wicked, two people that both know law. Okay? Okay? That we have two people. So then at least there's some basis of relating them. Now the question is, such a person, what does it mean? He doesn't understand knowledge. Say he doesn't understand law. Right, that's a good question. Why doesn't it say he doesn't understand law? Why does it say he doesn't understand knowledge? The poor are good or bad. Just says he's poor. That's all. We don't know anything about him. We're saying that the wicked person uses the system for his own benefit. Now, the righteous that work on the justice of the poor, so that shows that he's not using the system for his own benefit. He's only using it to help other people. So therefore, it's not for his own benefit. You understand? So that we have a connection there. Okay? It's still not 100% clear, but at least we have a connection. That would explain what Din Dalam is doing here. Din, the law of the poor, shows the difference in the nature between the righteous and the wicked. The righteous look at law more objectively. In other words, they look at it for other people, an objective thing, while the wicked look at it more of a subjective thing. The wicked person must know the law of the poor. What does it mean, the law of the poor? Let's say, for instance, he's working for a rich man, right? And he's going to make a lot of money, and he's working against a poor person, the wicked person, right? So he has to know the laws of the poor. Because he couldn't win the case. He has to know all aspects to be able to win the case. So he still knows the system. Righteous is definitely looking at it as a objective system for everybody, for the poor, even the poor. It's not for his own benefit. So therefore, the other side must be that the wicked do it for themselves, only subjective reasons. But what is that? But to win a case, he must have the knowledge of justice to win the case. So what does it mean he doesn't understand knowledge? Two possibilities in what it means the wicked doesn't understand knowledge. One possibility is the guy is not a thinker. That's it. He doesn't have knowledge. So, okay, that's one way. Or we say, no, the wicked does have the knowledge of the law, but still in all that, it's still, since he doesn't know the law of the poor, so he doesn't have knowledge, whatever that means. But the first way, if you try to say, that's the two possibilities that we're working on, okay? Now, all my question is that if you say it's the first way, namely that the wicked do not have knowledge, then what do I need King Solomon to tell me that one person has knowledge and one person doesn't? Of course, if somebody's a scientist and somebody's not a scientist, so the scientist has knowledge and the guy that doesn't have science is not a scientist, so he doesn't have any knowledge. So therefore, then what is King Solomon telling me? I don't need King Solomon to tell me this. That he has knowledge of law, but he doesn't have knowledge of justice. Fine. And it also, the first half of the verse is also saying that the righteous have knowledge of knows the law. Doesn't say anything about justice. says it knows the law of the poor. So fine, at least, okay, fine, I can accept that. One knows the law of the poor, and one knows no law, right? But just person, but you can't tell me he doesn't understand knowledge. You're telling me he doesn't understand knowledge. If you tell me he doesn't understand justice, then I would agree with you. But it's not saying that. It's saying that he doesn't understand knowledge. All right. One person wants to say that since we're dealing with the poor, so the thing is there's a lot of people that have mercy on the poor. So we want to say what we have both in common, both sides in common, is both that the righteous and the wicked have mercy on the poor. But why do we call them wicked? Because the righteous recognizes this quality of mercy, but it doesn't allow him to affect, he doesn't allow this emotion of mercy to affect his justice. But however, the wicked person who has mercy, right, but his mercy will affect the system of justice and will change the system of justice because of this mercy. Thing is like this. So what he's saying, in other words, is like this. What it means he doesn't understand knowledge, it doesn't mean the subject of law. It means he doesn't have self-knowledge to recognize how the mercy is affecting his thinking process. And that's why he's making an unjust decision here, because the mercy is affecting his understanding, and that's what it means he doesn't have knowledge. While the righteous man, even though he might have mercy, but however he would not let this mercy affect, that's what it means, he knows the law of the poor. And the reason why it mentions poor, to show the quality of mercy. Is that correct? The question is like this. In other words, you're saying that you're talking about a very righteous, good person. And he has really a good quality that has mercy on the poor, which he must say is a good quality. And that his mercy affects his thinking process, which it can happen. But the question is, would I call that person wicked? I might call him a fool, because he's lacking knowledge. I would use the term in Proverbs, King Solomon uses a fool. That I would call a fool, not wicked. You see, but to call a person like that wicked, to say that if a person allows his emotion to interfere in an area of justice, so then the guy has to be wicked. I mean, he's condemning the race. He's giving one person something in law that he doesn't deserve. Yeah, be wicked. The answer that Yossi gave as a valid answer seems to fit into the pasuk. But however, we also want to give another approach. And that is this. And that is, when we started out, we said that one side shows that the righteous is objective, right? And the wicked person, even though he knows law, he uses the law for his own benefit, right? Now that, when you have knowledge, but it's only for a subjective. In other words, it's only for your own usage. Okay? What the possibility is that King Solomon is saying that that person doesn't have an understanding of knowledge. He's missing something. In other words, if you understand, you have a science, like law, and you have it clear, you're a good lawyer, you could win all cases. But the only thing is you use it for subjective things, only for your personal self. That is somehow, you don't understand knowledge. You're lacking an understanding of knowledge. You have knowledge, but you're lacking in the understanding of knowledge. But if you have it where you deal with the poor, which is no benefit, you're just looking at it objectively, so then that shows that you truly have knowledge. Now, the only question is, what is lacking in the subjective person? I like the second approach better. It might be wrong. I don't know. I don't have all the answers. But it's closer to the pusik, and we're not bringing in a new quality of mercy, which is not mentioned in the pusik.
I'm not saying the answer is incorrect. The answer of mercy is definitely correct. It fits into all aspects of the pasuk. But there are two possibilities, and one doesn't have to interject a new quality, then that would be closer to the pasuk, closer to the verse. That the word din dalam itself shows the idea of mercy, and therefore you're not bringing anything new, but it's really in the verse. That's a good point. That's a good point. To understand the second way, also, if we can answer the question, what does it mean he doesn't understand knowledge? He's lacking something in knowledge. He has a science. He understands justice. But yet he's lacking something, and it's understanding. And that's what we want to understand when he says that he's lacking a certain understanding. There are there are two ways you could look at knowledge, okay? One way you could look at knowledge is that you need it for practical reasons, right? Like you need a hammer. You need it for practical reasons, so you use the hammer for practical reasons, right? But there's another reason why I want to have knowledge. Because I want to understand the nature of how things work. The nature of the world. What is this world? You see? Use the study of science only for a subjective thing, then you don't understand the nature of the world. Which is the ultimate purpose of knowledge, is to understand the nature of the world. When you understand the nature of the world, then that's the purpose of science, to understand. As a side product, if you have that knowledge, you can have benefit. But if you only use it for the benefit, then you don't understand the nature of the world. You're only using it for practical things. So therefore, you really don't have any understanding of science itself. You don't even understand what you're doing. Have knowledge. He only has a practical thing. Practically, he lives a good life. He lives a life. He can do certain things in life. But he doesn't understand the value of knowledge. Knowledge is simply, the purpose of all knowledge is simply to understand reality. Now, the thing is that he has no understanding of reality. He knows how to do something. But he has no real understanding of knowledge. He has no understanding of the world. But if a person that uses it objectively, so that shows that he's looking at it, the whole thing objectively is just simply in reality. This is the reality. So knowledge is to give him reality. Be the case with the lawyer. Why? Because the wicked lawyer only knows law only insofar as it benefits him, but he doesn't see that as a part of the nature, some nature in society that society operates. Once you see that, so you see how the intertwinings of nature and the whole system, you also see the purpose, what David wants to say before the purpose. That's also included. He sees the purpose, he sees the nature of the thing, he sees the whole thing, you see? So therefore he has knowledge. But a guy that only uses it practically, he doesn't have knowledge because he's not searching for what's the nature of the physical world. Let's say, for instance, a person that knows how to fix a car, and a person that knows the science of mechanics. I mean, one is a physicist and one is just a mechanic. If he doesn't have knowledge. Now, but by law, there's a science in itself, so you might not notice that you see a lawyer, you say, boy, he knows law. The answer is no. He doesn't have any knowledge. You know, he's like a mechanic. He knows how to do things. You see? Well, it's the same thing like a doctor and a researcher. You see, a researcher, he knows, he sees the whole system. The doctor knows, has knowledge, but he doesn't see it as a system. He just sees it as an application. You see this symptom, you apply this, but he doesn't see it as a system. He only sees it only in a practical way, so he doesn't really have science. But we have two different approaches to this verse. According to Yossi's approach, then the subject here is the tzaddik has self-knowledge and the wicked don't have self-knowledge. So then what's the subject? Two opposites, that's not the subject. There are two ways in having knowledge of reality, okay? One is
I just have the knowledge of reality, but I don't know how I relate to it. I don't think about how I relate to it. And since I don't think about it, so therefore it could affect me. Well, one is that I have knowledge of reality, but I have, I know how I'm affected by that knowledge, so I'm careful to make sure that that doesn't change the knowledge itself. You see? So it's two different ways of understanding a science. You see? Because sometimes, let's say I could understand the science, but I don't understand how I'm affected. So since I don't know how I'm relating to it, I don't know how I relate to it. So since I don't know how I relate to it, so therefore it could affect how I study the science or how I deal with the science. But on the righteous, right, he has the knowledge of the science and he also has the knowledge of how he relates to the science. So therefore, it's two ways of understanding the science. In other words, a person has knowledge of the science and how I relate to it. A person has knowledge of science without knowing how it relates to it. That was Yossi's approach. The other approach, what was the subject in the other approach? Opposites, that's always easier. What's the opposite? The opposites here are, I see the universe, right? Or I just see the practical. In other words, science is either, the study of science is only a means to the practical, or it's a means to understand the universe. That's the two opposites. Okay? Now, what is the subject? This is how I relate to knowledge itself. The first definition, Yossi's definition, was knowledge and I see how I relate to the knowledge, okay? The second way we're learning is what is the nature of knowledge. Is the nature of knowledge a practical thing, or is the nature of knowledge the understanding of the universe, how the world works? The Pasuk is, we're doing Pasuk tests, and the Pasuk says, a wise man who goes and has a discussion with a fool, and he gets angry, and he laughs, and there is no peace. A wise man who has a debate with a fool, he gets angry, and he jokes, and there is no peace. And he has no peace. Is that we have to discuss what is the proverb and fill in the pronouns. There are two ways in filling in who gets angry and who laughs. It could either be the wise person or the fool, and who doesn't have peace, that's really the wise person. That can only be the wise person. He doesn't sense a feeling of any type of, you know, like, a worthwhile thing. He doesn't feel that it was worthwhile. That's definitely the second half. But who gets angry and who jokes, that we're not sure of. Now we have to decide which way we're going to go. Peace cannot be attached to the fool is because the fool is never at peace. He hasn't the foggiest idea what peace is, or relaxation, or a comfort zone. He's constantly driven by his emotions, so he definitely doesn't have peace. Peace is a result of knowledge. We're going to take it as that the wise man gets angry and the wise man laughs, and yet he has no peace. The first half and the second half of this verse is simply a continuation. It's not like two sides. This verse is slightly different from the others is because the verse simply follows straight through. It's not like two sides. First half is setting up the situation that the wise man is in debate with a fool. And then it tells what the wise man does. He gets angry and he laughs, right? Whatever that means. And he has no peace. That's the result. That's all. So usually we have two sides in the verse, right? This time it's was set up slightly different. We have the basic facts of the proverb. Now we could start without questions see what we don't understand. And this is why will he dispute with a fool altogether? Okay, that's the first question. Get angry and why would he laugh? I mean, you get into dispute, it's a rational thing. It should only say that he should argue with them rationally. Suddenly it says he gets angry and he laughs. I mean, why? For what purpose? For what reason? That's a good question. This means that no matter how much he tries and how much he works with it, he can't feel satisfied. He will not feel any type of satisfaction in such a discussion. There's absolutely no gain. That's what they know. There's absolutely no benefit in the whole discussion. That's what's saying, and we're saying that it's a worthless thing. The question really is anger and laughter two opposite things? Which one? You know what I mean? Which one is the right one? You see? So the thing is that when you're dealing with a beginner, you can't go totally logic. You can't go totally rationale. It's not going to get them. So there has to be certain emotions. So when you're dealing with them, sometimes you have to show an emotion of anger in a certain situation. And in certain situations, you have to show an emotion of laughter and joy. And the thing is, it's not a matter as a reaction on the wise man's part, but it's a matter of what is necessary to talk to the fool. Okay? Is now what is now? Of course, I mean, I understand. So he talks to a fool, and there's no nachas. I understand. But the thing is, so what is he getting at, and what's the subject here? And what are the two sides? You know, like he doesn't set it up like the usual pasuk. I mean, I think the interpretation what we said till now is correct, but I don't. But I feel like left hanging because I don't see what the subject is. And what he's getting at, and what is he comparing it to, like there's something lacking. There's, in other words, sometimes he has to joke about it, and sometimes he has to get angry about it, and, you know what I mean, like get involved, and, you know, there's different ways, different emotions, but however, there's really no success. He doesn't feel like, in other words, he's doing all these things to help reach the fool, but however, there is absolutely no... the guy doesn't accept, the guy doesn't buy it. That's why he's not satisfied. He's doing all this to get to him, and it's not going to help anyway. You're right. In other words, if the purpose is to get them to think rationally, but you need to start from their emotions, when you start from their emotions to bring them to the rationale, that's the way it should be done. Okay, but the only thing is we still don't understand the verse. Check out the verse. Is this the only type of fool? I mean, in other words, the fool over here is a beginner. You're trying to get him involved, right? Aren't there certain beginners that when you use these emotional things and show them the rationale, and they start seeing the rationale via the emotions, and then they really are accepted. Then they really do accept. Then he would be successful, right? Okay? So the thing is, and that's the opposite of this type of fool. Way we could have the two, at least have the two sides, and now search for the subject. For it's, what we're saying is that there's certain types of fools that no matter how much psychological ways that you operate to get him enticed and interested into the world of ideas, he will not listen, right? There's certain people that they need the emotions to get them started, but they recognize the truth and they are drawn to the truth, right? So there's two types of people. In other words, that a beginner needs to be drawn via the emotions. But then when he hit, but you are discussing rationale, you see? And then, right, you're via the emotion, you are discussing rationale. Now, the fool of this pasuk is the fool that does not accept it, right? But there will be people, fools, which means beginners, right, that will accept it. Now, why can't there be the opposite? Thing is the Chacham uses these, in other words, whenever every beginner that he gets involved in, he has to do it in a nice way, like Abraham. Abraham used to invite people to his house and have an open door, says the reason for that was to make them feel comfortable, and they should be in an accepting way to hear his arguments. But when it comes down to the bottom line, they have to listen to his arguments. You see? So the thing is that that's what we have to do to all people. Now, this verse is telling us that there are certain people that it's not going to work on. It's not going to work. But the opposite of this is that there are people that it will work on. This doesn't seem to be the style of King Solomon in his book, because King Solomon usually gives two sides. And here he's only giving one side. So I believe is that this book is for the beginner. And many times when you're going to read things, it's not set up exactly so clearly like King Solomon set it up. And so therefore, along the way, King Solomon set up verses in other ways that once you learn to realize that you have to, how to think, then you know exactly what you're looking for, even though when it was written, it was not set up so clearly that you know exactly what you're going for. See, this book was written for a beginner, so it has to be set up that's very, very clear. But then and along the book, he might set it up other ways. So as to training to know what to look for in this subject, so when you get into other books where they write differently, the mind is already trained to know what to look for. That's why I think he does it this way. I think that there could be a lot of possibilities what the opposite is. If it really makes sense, another possibility, then we'll have to say there are two rational possibilities. But if there's only one possibility, so that's the possibility we'll accept. Right now I see the possibility is that the wise man has to use some type of an emotional thing to draw you. Like Abraham had people he invited to their homes and he had an open house. Then the Rambam says he began to discussions with them to try and get him involved in the ideas of God. You see? But the thing is that was the thing. But there are certain people he would get and he would be able to reach, even though he does it correctly. See, if the teacher does it incorrectly, so then it could be he didn't reach the person because the teacher did it incorrectly. But sometimes when you do it correctly, you see, again, sometimes you could be successful and sometimes you can't be successful. Okay? So therefore, that's what the verse is saying. The verse is saying is that that the Chacham does it correctly, and even when he does, if he doesn't do it correctly, so of course he won't be successful. Or if it's if he is successful, it's just a fluke. But the thing is, even when you do it correctly to reach out to people, so there will be fools that will not be able to accept the rationale with all the emotional draw. The thing is that the Chacham doesn't know. He has to always try. Because even sometimes, sometimes a student seems like he's not going to make it, and he does make it. And there's certain students that seems like they will make it, and they don't make it. You have to know that you can't quit. You don't know all the possibilities. You just got to keep going. But he is saying, the verse is saying, that just because you do all the correct things, just because the wise person does all the correct things, that doesn't mean he's going to be successful. But that doesn't mean he shouldn't do it unless he knows the guy is, he really knows that, that there's nothing left. But at a certain point, you could see that. But when you first start, you don't know because the guy is the beginner. You don't know if he'll accept it or not. So therefore, you must always try. Okay? But the thing is that whether you'll be successful or not, that you'll find out later. Anger or joking depends on the situation. The Chacham has to know which one to use. It's not that he has to use them. There might be other ways of doing it, you know what I mean? But the thing is that they're different. Like sometimes, let's say for instance in school, sometimes we take the kids out and they have a good time and we go someplace. Sometimes we have to sit down the rule and tell them certain rules and certain things, and also in the discussion and all these things. When you get involved with the person that is a beginner, you must take into account his emotions. It has to be. So therefore, that's the when you're dealing with the beginner, you must always do that. Which one you're going to use, that you, the Chacham, is going to follow the situation and decide as the events come out. But that still doesn't mean, even if he does all the correct ways of reaching the fool's emotions, it doesn't mean he's always going to be successful. Sometimes he will be successful, sometimes he won't. There's another suggestion on what the subject is, okay? Suggestion is that really the subject is the chacham, not the fool. And what we're dividing is between anger. Sometimes he gets angry, that's one side, and sometimes he jokes around, and that's the other side, right? The only thing is to have two sides. The only reason why we can't accept this is because to have two sides, okay, you must have two different results. If you have the same results, so then it's the same. It's under the same category. What shows me that it's a different category is because I'm getting a different result. If I get a different result, that shows me I'm getting a different category. But if I have the same result, that shows that it's the same category. That's why even though anger and laughter are opposites, in this verse, we put it in the same subject, because the thing is it brings the same result comes about. It just simply, we put it one category as the emotions. Okay? In other words, you're right. We have to define two different types of fools, right? One fool that when the chacham does it correctly, we're only talking about where the chacham does it correctly, right? So when the chacham does it correctly, there's a certain type of fool that could accept it, that he could get to the knowledge, and there's certain ones that can't. We have to define what the difference is, okay, between the two. That's fine. But the only thing is that, but still in all, that's the only opposite that makes mistakes in the fool, not in the chacham. Because if you're going to try and make a distinction in the chacham, you're going to have two ways of teaching something, or he made a mistake or he didn't make it, something like that. You have to have two opposite results. And if you try the anger and the laughter, that's not opposite results. That's the techniques that he used to get his results, depending on the situation. King Solomon is giving you the information that there's certain types of fools that if you do everything correctly, you will reach them. And there's certain types of fools, or beginners, that you use everything right and you will reach them. Well, I said before, you won't reach them, whatever, the opposite. Right? Now the thing is, so he's giving us this type of information. Now we must define what's the nature of the fool that we could reach and the nature of the fool that we can't reach. What happens? What's wrong? King Solomon gave me the information from the verse was the fact that because all along in his whole book, he always showed me in every verse that there's two sides, and the two sides are ways of measuring a certain subject. That's the way we analyzed every verse. So therefore, since I know that's the method of thought, so when I come to a verse that only tells me one side, I must analyze what is the other side. Now whatever makes sense, that's the side I'm going to, the opposite side. And then once I have the two opposites, now I can analyze the two opposites and its nature. And once we define the nature of the two type of fools, then maybe we could find the subject. Wise person cannot define which fool or which beginner he's going to make and which he doesn't beforehand. It's not before the discussion. It's only after discussion that he'll try to, that he'll show it. Well, we want to say that the difference between the fool that accepts and the fool that doesn't accept is that once you get past all the emotions, you see, the rationale itself comes through. And some people, if they didn't see the rationale, they say, hey, yeah, that makes sense. But some people, for some reason, have strong emotions against this rationale. Because especially the ideas of Torah, where it dictates how to live, so these ideas are going to affect his lifestyle, and it's immediately going to affect his emotions. So therefore, he's at that point, he's going to fight. With all the niceness and all the things, it's still the emotions is going to come through it because he doesn't want to change his lifestyle. Okay? So that's the two sides. But however, the question is, so if that is true, if it's in the final result, it's only the ideas that are going to turn him on or off, so then why do you have to have all the anger and the laughter and all these things to begin with? Why don't you go straight to the ideas? The answer is because if you go straight to the ideas, nobody will listen. You have to entice a person. person never experienced ideas. He doesn't know what it is. You have to entice him. It takes time for a person to see what an idea is. It's not one discussion or two discussions. It's dozens and hundreds of discussions. And you have to entice him and get him to stay, to stick it out, to really see which way to go. And that you have to draw him with every emotion that you can. And sometimes it's emotion of anger. Sometimes it's emotion of toughness. Sometimes you got to show pleasantness. They're all different things, in all different ways, depending on the nature of the person you're talking to, depending on the situation. So therefore, you have to keep him involved in the ideas until the ideas itself, he sees these, that means he has to live with the ideas. Then you don't have to do this. Then you just sit down and have discussions with him. You don't have to do all of these things because he's into it. He wants it himself. You see? So the thing is that once he wants it, then you don't have to bother with these things. But there's certain people with all these things, once you get down to the ideas, they suddenly realize that just for a minute I have to change my whole lifestyle around. Once you have to do that, then they quit. You see? That is the type of fool that quits. That you can never know before. Meet them, they're all not interested. Who's interested in going to school? You know what I mean? So the thing is, you have to make it interesting. For some reason, they should want to come. You see? That you must keep up until the wisdom comes through and he sees the love of ideas. Now, once that happens, once the wisdom comes through and he sees how it's going to affect him, one person is happy because he sees the benefit of the life. And the other guy, his emotion says, no, I don't want that. I don't want those controls. So he says, no, I'm not going to accept it. He turns away. That could mean the positive side of education. In other words, it could be a joke to make a fun class. It could be a compliment. It could be a compliment and guidance and being nice to the person, saying a good morning, a nice thing. The opposite side, the anger, is that you have to sometimes show a person anger. Like, for instance, when Avram invited everybody, that was the happy side, you see? So the thing is that everything, however you relate to the beginner or the student, it's going to have to be with either a happy face or an angry face, one of the two, or a sad face, depending on the situation. I think what they're measuring is a beginner's relationship to truth and reality. In other words, the beginner, when he first hears truth and reality, it just goes straight to his soul, and he just says, hey, yeah, that's really true. Like, it's just a certain sense that it's true. The other person, it never gets to that part of him, never gets to the soul, because what happens is it hits an emotion, and the emotion says, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I want to have a good time. I don't want to stop what I'm doing. I don't want to change my life, you see? That's what we're measuring. We're measuring a beginner's view of truth, his first view of truth. There's two ways. Either it goes right down to his soul, or there's an emotion that says, no, I don't want to live that. I want to live my emotional life. And so therefore he quits. Subject is a beginner's view of truth, a beginner's relationship to truth. Now, what happens is everybody has a soul, and everybody could relate to truth.